It's just gone 4:30. So I'm joined by Nicola Upson in the studio, who you'll be hearing more of on Cambridge 105 over the coming months, but more about that another time, perhaps. But you've been on the station before, on Greg's show, haven't you?
Yes, and thoroughly enjoyed it. In fact, I was just saying to you, I'm used to expecting donuts when I come
yeah,
here,
sorry
and there's
about
nothing
that.
Today.
No, I could have offered you half a Mr. Kipling cake, but I've just eaten
you've
the
just
last
eaten
morsel.
It, yeah.
Sorry
okay.
about that. So you're here to tell us about the Mousetrap, which is on the Corn Exchange at the moment, which you had the pleasure of seeing on Monday, is that right?
I did, and it really was a pleasure, actually, because do you know, it's really stupid, Tim, but I make a living out of writing crime fiction, and I've never seen The Mousetrap.
Okay.
I have never seen
well,
the most famous...
I, but yeah, you've probably got less of an excuse
I'm
than me.
I'm supposed to know about Agatha Christie and all that sort
yeah.
of thing. So it was a real treat, actually, to be able to see it in Cambridge, because it's part of this Diamond Jubilee anniversary tour that's going around the country, and so rather than having to go to the West End, it was lovely to have it on your doorstep. But I have to say, I was a bit... confused about it being at the Corn Exchange, because I'm used to it being in these sort of more traditional theatres. I think you were telling me it's been to the Arts Theatre.
Yes.
I didn't know that, but it doesn't surprise me because it's used to that setting, and you worry that it might lose that intimacy.
Yeah, it's slightly unusual for the Corn Exchange to have a production like that.
But I hope they do more of it, because there was none of that loss of atmosphere at all. I mean, they had the red curtain right at the start, and from the moment that curtain goes back, you are thrown into the world of the Mousetrap, the ice isolated country house setting.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think the audience were just absolutely rapt from the beginning of that. And it was really lovely to see a play that you can go to. And in front of me, there was sort of the whole family, really. There was a little girl of about 8. There was a slightly older and grumpy brother. there were the parents. And I think that across the row, there were probably the grandparents as well. And every generation of that family was wrapped with that
production. Yeah, it's rare that you get shows like that that everybody will go to now.
It
apart
is.
From pantomimes and things like that, which are...
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think it's probably is the pantomime of crime fiction, actually.
Okay.
Because it is everything you would want from a classic whodunit. And that is its joy. And it is unashamedly a product of its time. I mean, from the early 50s, you're right there back in that setting. Nobody's messed with it. Nobody's trying to bring it up to date and set it in a detention centre or anything like that, or give backgrounds to the characters that didn't exist in Christie's world.
Mm.
And so it's really nice to be thrown into that world. And the basic premise is that a young couple have just started running a guest house, which is quite a magnificent oak panel, beautiful old country home that she's inherited. And they're not very good at it. It's that the first lot of guests are coming in. In the opening scene, she turns the wireless on, and there's a wonderful old-fashioned BBC announcement about a murder that's committed, and everybody should be on the lookout for a sort of medium-height stranger in a dark coat, a light scarf, and a dark felt hat.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, then when the guests start to arrive at the country house, everybody's wearing a dark coat and a light scarf, and it's little things like that that make such a good game. Now, I have a confession to... Well, it's not a confession, because it's not really my fault, but P.D. James told me who done it.
Right.
Now, you will probably know that one of the golden things about The Mousetrap is that after the production, somebody steps forward from the cast and asks the audience to keep that a secret, to preserve the tradition, which is one of the things that has enabled it to go for 60 years. And I have to say, knowing who done it, because it is a brilliant twist, did somewhat spoil that for me. Not completely, though, but I mean, for people going to that in complete ignorance of what the answer to Christie's puzzle is, and it has to be said that still, I think, you know, you can get all sorts of different crime fictions these days, and every society, every sort of puzzle, every sort of murder, but still it's very hard to find somebody who kind of plotted as well as Agatha Christie did, and who dealt those cards in unexpected ways. So going to that production not knowing would have been just the icing on the cake.
Well, in these
really.
Times it's very difficult to keep secrets like that,
isn't it?
So.
And I think that is the amazing thing, really. I mean, people have honoured that tradition of theatre. Which is lovely. And of course, a great gift. The other nice thing about the Mousetrap is the kind of backstory behind it, the fact that Agatha Christie gave the rights to it to her grandson as a birthday present when he was a little boy. And of course, you know, what a gift that would have been.
Yeah, definitely. So you enjoyed it and you really thought it was good.
I thought the atmosphere that was created was brilliant. I thought the setting was lovely with the snow outside the window. Special, I think, comment for the lighting as well. The lighting's brilliant. And all the actors are, you know, they're top class right across the board.
And had you seen it before?
No, never.
Okay, so you just knew who had done it and somebody else told you.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And I don't think
so
I would
never get the experience of watching it and not knowing who did it.
No. Oh. And I don't think I would have guessed either, actually, because it's not something I should admit to, really. But I'm rubbish at guessing who done it. So I'd never have got it in a million years.
All
but
right.
It is a good twist.
So this is on tour at the moment, then?
It's on tour, yeah, but it's at the Corn Exchange until this Saturday. So there is still the evening performances and a matinee on Saturday as well.
Okay, do you know how much tickets are?
Tickets start at £25 and go up to £31.50 for the more expensive evenings. And you can book them, obviously, online at the Corn Exchange or on the Corn Exchange box office number, which is Cambridge 357851.
And obviously, you were opening night, so I guess it was pretty packed.
It was a good audience, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Okay. But not surprising, because it still has that draw, the wide appeal that we were speaking about earlier. And easily recommended to any age group.
One of the things that we had Neil Jones in on Friday, he was talking about what's coming up at the Corn Exchange. One of the things that he said is that they've just, I think this is probably the first production they've done since they've reopened after the summer, and they've made a few improvements to the Corn Exchange. I don't know whether you noticed anything that stood out. The toilets were particularly nice.
They were posh, actually. We did comment on the quality of the toilets.
There you go.
Yeah, the hand wash is lovely.
Brilliant, okay.
Yeah, really. And the bar area is much more spacious and it's really, really nice.
Yeah, he said they'd gone to town on it this summer and made some improvements.
Absolutely. Well, certainly, you know, the interval felt really comfortable, because sometimes at the Corn Exchange it could have been a victim of its own success when you had really well-selling shows.
It
was a bit packed in there and the queues at the bar. Yeah, but it seemed much better this time.
Okay, that's reassuring. All right, then. Thank you very much for that.
Pleasure.
I'm glad you came in and told us about that. I've been thinking about going to see it. I'm not sure I'm going to get time to now.
I think you should.
If I don't get to see it here, I'll have to go and see it somewhere else.
Yeah, and of course it was who did it.
Yeah, don't tell me who did it. Thank you very much. It's 5:30. You're listening to Cambridge 105. Tim in for Julian tonight until 7:00. So the Good Pub Guide came out last week, I believe, and there were a few Cambridge pubs in it. And it's been a pretty bad time for Cambridge pubs generally. A lot of bad press about them closing down or being bulldozed or whatever it might be. So I thought we'd do a good news piece. So we're here with Dom Smith, who is our resident show pub expert.
Good evening, Tim.
Not an alcoholic, just likes to frequent pubs a lot. And Neil McGovern from CAMRA, what does CAMRA stand for, Neil?
CAMRA is the Campaign for Real Ale.
Campaign for Real Ale. Okay, lovely. And so you were the guys that sent us the press release about this, the Good Pub Guide and Cambridge pubs being featured.
Yeah, absolutely.
First of all, though, Tim, I'm going to correct you quickly, because actually this is the Good Beer Guide.
Good
Beer Guide and the Good Pub Guide are two different publications.
Oh.
So actually, that was actually my first question was going to be about that. So how does the Good Beer Guide actually get created?
So the Good Beer Guide is important to state first that it doesn't charge for entries, and pubs are selected on their merit alone. So here in Cambridge, it's essentially voted on by members of CAMRA, who recommend and suggest pubs that they think are really excellent and deserve highlighting in this way.
So Cambridge CAMRA, which has got sort of several thousand members, I believe, everyone just gets together in one big room and sort of shouts, I want to vote for this one, or how does it work?
They send in their nominations, and then the branch committee produces a shortlist, and that's voted on in the end.
Right, okay. So presumably you're the Campaign for Real Ale. This means that the pubs that are going to be included are going to be the pubs that tend to serve ale a lot. So you're kind of excluding the pubs that are community focused, but maybe they don't concentrate on ale, they concentrate on games or just sort of food for families, that sort of thing.
Well, I think it's a lot of the good community pubs in the area are tend to be the ones that serve real ale anyway. I think there's only one pub left in Cambridge itself that doesn't actually serve some sort of real ale.
Mm-hmm.
So we're seeing a real uptake in that as people move towards having real ale and customer demand for that within local pubs in the area.
Right, excellent. So the press release you sent us said that there were 26 of the 4,500 pubs that are in the Good Beer Guide are in the Cambridge area. Mm-hmm. That's actually quite a few, isn't it? How many pubs are there sort of in the Cambridge area roughly, do you know?
The last time I checked, I think we had approximately over 200 pubs in mm-hmm. total in the area. So it's a fairly select number. It's a real mark of quality for these be selected.
Yeah, so there's a sort of 1 in 10 in that case, something like that, getting into the good...
It's a pretty good ratio.
It is, it's not bad at all. Mm. And as you were saying, actually, Tim, this is a good news story in a way, that there are so many pubs getting in. When I was preparing for this interview, I checked my 5-year-old copy of the Good Beer Guide, and there were only 10 Cambridge pubs that had made it into the 2008 edition, so it seems like things are actually on the up.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we're looking close this year to being the first year in many years that there's going to be the same number of pubs or more pubs open than there are shut this year. In addition, we've got the Pint Shop, which might be open on Pease Hill, which will be the first new pub opened in about 17 years. So it's really helping in the local area to try and boost the local community.
Yeah, excellent. And there's some of the pubs that you've been highlighting a lot recently. The Cambridge Pub of the Year was the Flying Pig down near the train station. We reviewed it on the Pub of the Month a few months ago. Wonderful little place, and it hasn't been in for several years.
Again, we've seen that one come back in. The sort of entry bar has really been risen by pubs like the Mill and the White Swan in Stoke-on-Quay, and seeing these sort of things come up and really make an effort to try and push for that is... Well, certainly they view it as valuable as well.
Yes, and I was pleased to see another new entrant in the list this year is the Hopbine, which, again, we reviewed a couple of months ago, and that has just had a complete turnaround in the last sort of under the new management and a complete refurbishment. So we are very lucky in Cambridge. We have a number of pubs which will be very familiar to a lot of ale drinkers in the area: the Cambridge Blue, the Elm Tree, the Free Press, etc., etc. And of course the Cambridge Brew House more recently as well opened. Are there any surprises in the list that sort of that aren't in that normal sort of routine list?
I think we've seen quite a few that's really brought up again, like I mentioned the Mill, which mm-hmm. used to not feature very heavily in it at all. It has shown things like how if a pub, if it's run very well and successfully, and it's not run by, say, a big pub company who takes a lot of the profit from it, can be really successful. So it's just been really good to see the people really improve their local pub and be very keen to make sure that happens.
Excellent. So it is about that sort of independence as well, and sort of the community focus, serving what the community are requesting, essentially. So if you weren't really familiar with the real ale scene, and you walk into some of these pubs, so there's a great array of hand pumps, the number of bottles in the fridge, it could be quite intimidating. Have you got sort of any recommendations for where to start?
Yes, I mean, well, obviously if you can make it down to any of the beer festivals that Camera runs, then that's a really good opportunity to try different beers. But if you just walk into a pub, I'd say the best thing to do is just ask the bar staff. If you're in one of these pubs, normally the staff are very knowledgeable about different things and the sort of things they like and things that you might like. So asking them is normally a really good start.
Okay, Tim can try that next time he's in the Cambridge Blue, just down the road from our studios.
Give Cambridge Blue an example, because you only have to walk in the door there and you're confronted with a huge fridge of all sorts of things to try. And I don't drink very often, but I wouldn't know where to start. And it sort of frightens me to a certain extent, I think, because it's a certain pressure on you, really. So you have to pick something that you're going to like, because if you don't like it, it might put you off having beer again or going back to that pub or whatever it might be. So it's like, it's a bit like food as well. You've got to go to a restaurant, you've got to make sure you pick something that's nice, and if you don't, you regret it.
Mm. So just turning on to the slightly bad side of the story, mm-hmm. I guess. Camera are still saying that nationally about 25 pubs a week are closing, roughly. Are there any pubs that we've lost in the last year that you would have wanted to see in the guide this year?
I think there's certainly some that have been lost, which is a real shame. So you have things like the Queen Edith's, which is traditionally been the only pub in the area, which has been quite a blow for that community. On a slightly better news, it looks like there is a planning application that's been approved now to open a new pub on that site and really improving the sole location. The few others, for example, like the Penny Ferry, has been quite bad, but mostly it's things like the Haymakers in Chesterton, which has been reopened recently by Milton Brewery and is now quite a thriving pub. So I think in general, I'm certainly hopeful that certainly some of the way Cambridge Council have implemented new local plans for the area will help protect those pubs and really help drive them.
Yes, we were talking on the Pub of the Month a few weeks ago about the new community pubs listing that the Camera is supporting as well. So you say that you mentioned the Cambridge Camera Ale Festival as a way of getting started. I'll let you do the plug. Oktoberfest coming up?
Yes, it is. That's, I believe, on the 18th and 19th, Friday and Saturday. That's at the USC. So loads of real ales there and loads of local beers that people can try.
And that's on Mill Lane, sort of just basically next to the Punt Station.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, so where can we buy a copy of the Good Beer Guide?
You can get it online or, again, at any of the beer festivals around. I think it's now being stocked by quite a few booksellers as well, so that's good to see.
Excellent. Good stuff. Neil McGovern, from spokesperson from Cambridge Camera. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much, Neil, for coming. It's interesting. So I don't visit pubs that often, but it's interesting to me to hear this, and it's good that Cambridge has got so many pubs in this particular guide. Where does Cambridge sit in comparison to some other places in the country in terms of the proportion of pubs that are in this guide, do you think?
I think we're doing pretty well, and that's taken by the number of members that we have and a few others. There are other hotspots throughout the country which have a really good collection as well. But I think we normally do pretty well for the region, probably because we have a lot of really good pubs that we're trying to really work hard with.
Yeah, definitely. All right, thank you very much for coming in. Cheers. Killers, you're listening to Cambridge 105. 105 Drive till 7. It's Thursday. Doesn't feel like it's been a week since we last did this, but it's time to talk movies. Sky is here, and so is Hattie. Hello.
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 How are we?
Very well, very excited over the next couple of weeks, what with the Cambridge Film Festival starting up.
Mm, busy time.
But we'll start off with the current releases and reviewing them for you now. Hattie?
Okay, I'm going to start with Rush, and I believe we have a clip.
We do.
Emergency. That was the racetrack. There's been an accident. The driver's been injured. He's coming in now.
Hello. I think the racetrack telephoned ahead that I was coming. Hunt, James Hunt.
I had a friendly disagreement with another driver about his wife.
Why? What did he do?
I'd be happy to show you if you like.
James can be a loose cannon, but in terms of raw talent, there is no better driver in the world.
Why don't they make it safer?
Risk of death turns people off.
Who's that?
It's Niki Lauda.
He's just been signed by Ferrari.
I'm both quicker than you. Better at setting up the car.
James Hunt is a proven winner at the highest level.
Is there a question? Why are you just trying to piss me off?
This is an incredible battle between these two drivers.
I heard about this thing with Niki.
Everyone has.
James, do you think you can cope with the pressure?
To be a champion, you have to really believe it.
You're just a party guy.
They're killing us out there.
You're too far back.
So quicker than all of you.
I'm James Bond, he's out.
It's over, superstar.
More powerful than even the fear of death itself is the will to win.
Which is why I'm here begging.
You really think you can beat him?
Trust me.
Today with the rain,
the most dangerous trick in the world.
That all depends on how good you are in the rain.
Let's race.
Talk to me, James.
Don't go to men who are willing to kill themselves driving in circles looking for normality.
Niki Lauda, sat in a searing inferno of 800 plus degrees.
I feel responsible for what happened.
Watching you win those races, you were equally responsible for getting me back in the car.
Showdown between you and Niki is all anyone wants to see.
Yeah, a bit of dubstep. That's the trailer to Rush.
Okay, so this is, Rush. Chris Hemsworth put some pedal to the metal in the high-octane story of rival Formula One legends James Hunt and Niki Lauda. It's 1976, and Formula One motor racing is dominated by two contrasting larger-than-life personalities. Austrian-born Niki Lauda, played by Daniel Brühl, is a technically brilliant driver who worked his way methodically through the ranks to claim the number one spot at Ferrari. His rival at McLaren is handsome, charismatic, blonde Englishman James Hunt, played by Chris Hemsworth. Hunt's skill behind the wheel belies a louche playboy image, but this is a sport where vehicles and drivers are pushed to the absolute limit and death can be just a heartbeat away.
Mm.
So, it's a story of fast lives and faster cars. The world of Formula One translates really well to the big screen. It's got great visuals, the suspense, the sound is superb.
Yeah.
The volume is so much louder than in normal films. And it's that's what's what I really love about Formula One is that, you know, the engine rumbles go right through you.
Yeah.
Ron Howard, the director, has done fantastically. The writing is superb. Peter Morgan, who did... Frost Nixon and the Queen.
Mm-hmm.
So the relationship between Lauda and Hunt, although not entirely faithful to the truth, is highly strung, witty, and will leave you wanting them both back on screen together almost as soon as they leave.
Yeah, I sort of want a sequel, but there isn't anywhere else to go with that, unfortunately.
Not really, you know, without wanting to spoil it, but, you know, if you know history, then you kind of know how it ends. There's not too much further they can go with it.
Not really, no. No, I mean, I'm a big Formula One fan, and I had to go and see it, because... it's the only the second F1 film of recent times that's been made. Senna was the other one that was a few years ago, and I really liked Senna, but I have to say I prefer this one over the two. And I found it a bit of an education because I'm a modern F1 fan, so I've only been into it since sort of the early 90s. So this is the 70s, isn't it, when this is set? So this is a bit beyond my time. So I was learning as I was going along.
Yeah.
And the bits of information that I did know were fitting into place. So it really told the story really well.
That's and that's what I loved as well. I enjoy Formula One. I wouldn't call myself a massive fan. And I went with a very big Formula One fan as well. And we were both, you know, like, I can't quite believe how unsafe it all is. But you
it
know,
certainly was, yeah.
Yeah, and yeah, you can sort of fit things in with modern day Formula One.
I think the key with this as well is it's been really really well received amongst the Formula One community.
Yes.
Which is something that, you know, once that's happened, then you know that it's a good film.
Yeah.
So as you say, it does portray the situation really well. It's been supported by Niki Lauda himself, who I think is actually in it right at the end as well.
Yes.
In voice form rather than visual form.
You get a short clip of him right at the end, and I think that's really touching, you know. If the subject of the film gives it his seal of approval, then you know it's going to be pretty good. I don't think you particularly have to be a dedicated Formula One fan to be able to.
I think you can come into it cold, to be honest, because it tells the story well enough anyway.
Yes, and as you say, even if you are, then you'll appreciate the look back through the history of the sport. So the storyline keeps you hanging on as it races around hairpin bends with excellent performances from Daniel Brühl and Chris Hemsworth, who must have studied them down to a T. Done fantastically. It's utterly gripping and well worth a watch.
Okay.
I say. So it's on tonight at 8:50, tomorrow at 11:50 a.m., 2:40, 5:30, 8:20, and 11 o'clock in the evening, and plenty more showings through the weekend.
Yeah. Has it been quite popular, Sky?
Yes, it has been. Yeah. I haven't been to see it yet, so I'm kind of out of the loop.
But he will soon.
I will.
Something that's going to be around for a few weeks then.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. All right. We will come back and talk about the next film, which is White House Down. Not White Horse Down, as I accidentally called it earlier on. I got the muddled
That'd be
up.
A different story entirely.
Yes, indeed. Ronan Keating and Loving Each Day. It's Cambridge 105. It's 6:30. We're talking movies with Sky and Hattie. The next one we're going to talk about is White House Down.
Oh, I'm glad you said that, because I was originally going to say Olympus Has Fallen, because it's on a very similar premise that was out only a few months ago. Basically, paramilitary storm the White House in this relentless, thrilling blockbuster. Here's a clip.
If you are just tuning in, we are going to breaking news out of Washington.
Again, this is a developing story. There has been an explosion.
Absolutely shocking.
Officials searching for answers as to who, what, or why.
We are also getting unconfirmed reports of explosions.
What use is a diversion?
Got missile launch!
The situation has changed completely.
What the hell is happening?
Move, move, move!
Somebody tell me something!
tell me how much time I have.
Oh, it has. Okay. Just checking. Yep. Starring Channing Tatum and Jamie Foxx, the story is divorced Capitol Hill cop John Cale is desperate to be assigned to the president's secret service detail. His main aim is to win back the affections of his 11-year-old daughter, Emily. But when he fails to get the job, he offers her a tour of the White House instead. Bad timing. An explosion rips through the building. Father and daughter are separated, and heavily armed paramilitary thugs swarm through the corridors. Now John finds he must protect charismatic Obama-esque President Sawyer, as well as saving young Emily. Independence Day director Roland Emmerich blows up the White House for a second time in this breathless action movie. Its winning blend of buddy comedy and incredible stunts recalls the classic Die Hard and Lethal Weapon films, and Channing Tatum and Jamie Foxx make a brilliant double act as they take on the invaders. Okay.
That wasn't your opinion there you're reading out, was it?
Oh, no. No, you could tell the difference.
I was going to say, you weren't very complimentary about Channing Tatum a minute ago.
No, what did you say your mother thinks of Channing Tatum?
Channing Potato.
Because he's got the face of a potato.
Yeah, I don't think so.
I was going to say that's like his acting. But no.
But he's not that bad.
No, but Roland Emmerich, you know what you expect with his films. Yes, if you've seen Independence Day, which I think they're working on a sequel as well, possibly. But I think if aliens were in this film, it would be more believable than what I have just watched. You know, there's only so many times I can see Channing Tatum jump through a window in slow motion and, you know, explosions and, you know, I quite like Michael Bay's approach to it, but for me, Roland Emmerich's not in the same league. And you know, I've seen it all before, basically. Yeah, I mean, Day After Tomorrow, even Anonymous, I think, has like a very epic conspiratorial kind of nature to it. So yeah, it's about the enemy within, and I think there's some really dodgy political messages thrown in there as well. But at the end of the day, it is just a typical action fare of, you know, non-stop, in your face, and with the sort of quirky buddy comedy that you normally expect from those films like Die Hard. And say Olympus Has Fallen, probably Olympus Has Fallen was a bit more serious than this film, but you know, it'll kill 2 hours of your time, so yeah. That's
you should spend 2 hours watching something else then.
I would, personally.
Well, I quite enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
I
thought Sky got the short end of the stick.
A little bit.
It's because I couldn't watch Rush.
Sky doesn't like films that, you know, are too preposterous. Whereas I find them hilarious.
Well, I did watch Pacific Rim. That was about giant robots and giant aliens.
Yes.
But yeah.
Yeah.
I guess when
it's set in reality.
When it's set more in a sort of realistic, you know, I'm not expecting, like, you know, I expect there to be plot holes and stuff, but it's just the motivations between events and cause and effect. It just
very cliched
baffles
and very
me.
Obvious.
Exactly. Mm. So, but it's on at Cineworld tonight at 8:40, or you can see it at Vue at 8:10, and it will be showing over the weekend. Plenty of showings. So,
I don't think there'll be a queue of people going to see it after your review.
That's what I'm here for.
Well, you are a movie critic. Okay. You want to talk about one other thing? Cambridge Film Festival?
Yes, it's the 33rd Cambridge Film Festival. Obviously, you've mentioned a bit about the Hawking documentary that's on this evening at 7:25. There will be a Q&A with the directors, Stephen Finnegan and Ben Bowie, and also Stephen Hawking will be attending himself. Also to add to the opening of the film festival, Woody Allen's new film Blue Jasmine is out, starring Cate Blanchett,
Alec Baldwin, Sally Hawkins,
and a host of other top stars in this ensemble film. So we're looking forward to that.
Okay.
Going to go see it tonight as well. And Also, you got Nosferatu, the original German expressionist film, if you're into horror. Don't Look Now is also playing over the weekend. And The Shining is also on tonight at 8:30, which I believe Stephen Hawking has written a sequel quite recently.
Stephen King.
Stephen King? Stephen King.
Stephen Hawking.
with wormholes. check out listings on the Arts Picture House website and Cineworld as they're collaborating. Lots of different films, lots of different genres, world cinema, very eclectic and diverse. So check it out.
Okay, we've got a theatre piece to talk about as well.
Should we
play a song, come back for that one?
Let's.
Yeah, okay, right.
As long as it's a good song.
Exactly. Why don't you introduce it as you criticise Ronan Keating and The Killers?
This is The Wire by Haim.
Haim and The Wire, that's their new track. And you were saying, Hattie, that all their gigs are sold out.
Almost all of them, yes. They're very popular because they're very, very good.
Okay. Right, in a break with tradition, we're not going to talk about movies, we're going to talk about something that's on at the theatre, which unfortunately Emma's not here, but it's starring her.
It is indeed. This is I'll Be Seeing You on at the Corpus Playroom, set in Cambridge, 1940, a town steeped in history and tradition faces change. So I'll Be Seeing You offers a dramatic and poignant insight into life during the Second World War as social boundaries crack and family values are challenged. Three interweaving stories play out as the air raid sirens drone over the town that thought it was safe. So this, I was really impressed, actually. It's a delightful story. It's a little slow to begin with, but once you sort of get into it and you understand what's happening, it really sort of gets going. And the links between all three of the stories are really smart and quite subtle in places as well, I really liked.
Yeah, I mean, it's three separate stories taking place. They're all in three groups of people in their kind of makeshift bomb shelters during this air raid siren sounds. And so it's three different stories taking place at that same time, and there are little lines and little events that happen that kind of give you the impression that this is happening at the same time over the course of these three stories. And I think it dealt really well with ideas of, because so many of the middle-aged men have gone off to war, that you've got the women who are left behind, you've got the really young ones who obviously have the possibility of going to war, and then you've got the really old. So there's this huge generation gap, and as Hattie said, there's family values that are being, you know, lines that are crossed. It deals with sexuality and religion. So I think there's a lot going on in this play. So there's a lot of layers to it, and I think it progressively gets deeper and more interesting as it goes along.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the performances were brilliant as well. It's a cast of seven, I think.
Yeah.
Yes, and Emma was brilliant. She was absolutely a standout performance. She had great comic timing and her character's charming naivety as well.
She went to Edinburgh and did this at the Fringe Festival a few weeks ago, didn't she?
Yeah, she said it was successful while it was up there, and it was pretty much almost sold out as well last night.
The Corpus Playroom is quite small. It's an interesting shape as well, and for a touring sort of production, they had the minimal amount of set, but it worked really well because it's more focus on the characters and the words rather than action.
Doesn't draw away anything from the troubles and the emotions.
Exactly. Okay. So there you are.
So yes, it's definitely worth seeing. Tickets are £6 and £5 concessions. It's on at the Corpus Playroom tonight, tomorrow and Saturday at 7:45 PM, and tickets can be bought through the ADC box office and website.
Okay, lovely. There we go. Excellent. I feel as if I should go and see it to support Emma, really. There we go. Right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We've covered films, we've covered theatre, and we covered a little bit of music as well.
How cultured.
So there we go. I feel better off for having this half an hour. What are we talking about next week in terms of films? Have you got any ideas yet?
Actually, I haven't really thought about it, to be honest. We've got R.I.P.D., which has got Jeff Bridges and Ryan Reynolds in, and it's sort of a supernatural sci-fi film.
Okay.
And also, controversially, the new Diana film.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
right.
So that'll be interesting.
And Blue Jasmine as well.
And Blue Jasmine.
Okay, all right. Well, you've got me again next week, so I should look forward to that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.